He wondered what they would do if he took them by the hand and dragged them to his bedchamber. "None will dare refuse you," Illyrio claimed. But somehow Tyrion did not think he meant these two. The younger woman was old enough to be his mother, and the older was likely her mother. Both were near as fat as Illyrio, with teats that were larger than his head. "I could smother myself in flesh." There were worse ways to die, the way his lord father had died, for one. "I should have made him shit a little gold before expiring." Lord Tywin might have been niggardly with his approval and affection, but he'd always been open-handed when it came to coin. "The only thing more pitiful than a dwarf without a nose is a dwarf without a nose who has no gold." Tyrion left the fat women to their loaves and kettles and went in search of the cellar where Illyrio had decanted him the night before. It was not hard to find. There was enough wine there to keep him drunk for 100 years. Sweet reds from the Reach and sour reds from Dawn. Pale, pentushy ambers. The green nectar of Myrrh. 3 score casks of Arbor Gold, even wines from the fabled East. From Carth and Yaitai and Ashai by the Shadow. In the end, Tyrion chose a cask of strong wine marked as the private stock of Lord Runsford Redwine, the grandfather of the present Lord of the Arbor. The taste of it was languorous and heady on the tongue, the colour a purple so dark that it looked almost black in the dim-lit cellar. Tyrion filled a cup and a flagon for good measure, and carried them up to the gardens to drink beneath those cherry trees he'd seen. As it happened, he left by the wrong door and never found the pool he had spied from his window. But it made no matter. The gardens behind the manse were just as pleasant and far more extensive. He wandered through them for a time, drinking. The walls would have shamed any proper castle, and the ornamental iron spikes along the top looked strangely naked without heads to adorn them. Tyrion pictured how his sister's head might look up there, with tar in her golden hair and flies buzzing in and out of her mouth. "Yes, and Jamie must have the spike beside her," he decided. "No one must ever come between my brother and my sister." With a rope and a grapnel, he might be able to get over that wall. He had strong arms, and he did not weigh much. He should be able to clamber over if he did not impale himself on the spike. "He will search for a rope on the morrow," he resolved. He saw 3 gates during his wanderings, the main entrance with its gatehouse, a postern by the kennels, and a garden gate hidden behind a tangle of pale ivy. The last was chained, the others guarded. The guards were plump, their faces as smooth as a baby's bottom, and every man of them wore a spiked bronze cap. Tyrion knew eunuchs when he saw them. He knew their sort by reputation. They feared nothing and felt no pain, it was said, and were loyal to their masters unto death. "I could make good use of a few hundred of mine own," he reflected. "A pity I did not think of that before I became a beggar." He walked along a pillared gallery and through a pointed arch, and found himself in a tiled courtyard where a woman was washing clothes at a well. She looked to be his own age, with dull red hair and a broad face dotted by freckles. "Would you like some wine?" he asked her. She looked at him uncertainly. "I have no cup for you. We'll have to share." The washerwoman went back to wringing out tunics and hanging them to dry. Tyrion settled on a stone bench with his flagon. "Tell me, how far should I trust Magister Illyrio?" The name made her look up. "Oh, that far." Chuckling, he crossed his stunted legs and took a drink. "I am loath to play whatever part the cheesemonger has in mind for me, yet how can I refuse him? The gates are guarded. Perhaps you might smuggle me out under your skirts. I'd be so grateful. Why, I'll even wed you. I've 2 wives already, why not 3? Ah, but where would we live?" He gave her as pleasant a smile as a man with half a nose could manage. "I have a niece in Sunspare, did I tell you? I can make rather a lot of mischief in Dawn with Marcella. I could set my niece and nephew at war. Wouldn't that be droll?" The washerwoman pinned up one of Illyrio's tunics, large enough to double as a sail. I should be ashamed to think such evil thoughts. You're quite right. Better if I sought the wall instead. All crimes are wiped clean when a man joins the night's watch, they say. Though I fear they would not let me keep you, sweetling. No women in the watch, no sweet freckly wives to warm your bed at night, only cold winds, salted cod, and small beer. Do you think I might stand taller in black, my lady? He filled his cup again. What do you say, north or south? Shall I atone for old sins, or make some new ones? The washerwoman gave him one last glance, picked up her basket, and walked away. I cannot seem to hold a wife for very long, Tyrion reflected. Somehow his flagon had gone dry. Perhaps I should stumble back down to the cellars. The strong wine was making his head spin, though, and the cellar steps were very steep. Where do oars go? He asked the wash, flapping on the line. Perhaps he should have asked the washerwoman. Not to imply that you're a whore, my dear, but perhaps you know where they go. Or better yet, he should have asked his father. Wherever whores go, Lord Tywin said. She loved me. She was a crofter's daughter. She loved me and she wed me and put her trust in me. The empty flagon slipped from his hand and rolled across the yard. Tyrion pushed himself off the bench and went to fetch it. As he did, he saw some mushrooms growing up from a cracked paving tile. Pale white they were, with speckles, and red-ribbed undersides dark as blood. The dwarf snapped one off and sniffed it. Oh, delicious, he thought, and deadly. There were seven of the mushrooms. Perhaps the seven were trying to tell him something. He picked them all, snatched a glove down from the line, wrapped them carefully, and stuffed them down his pocket. The effort made him dizzy, so afterward he crawled back onto the bench, curled up, and shut his eyes. When he woke again, he was back in his bedchamber, drowning in the goose-down feather bed once more, while a blonde girl shook his shoulder.
"My lord," she said, "your bath awaits. Magister Illyrio expects you at table within the hour."
Tyrion propped himself against the pillars, his head in his hands. "Do I dream, or do you speak the common tongue?"
"Yes, my lord, I was bought to please the king."
She was blue-eyed and fair, young and willowy. "I am sure you did. I need a cup of wine." She poured for him.
"Magister Illyrio said that I am to scrub your back and warm your bed. My name
is of no interest to me. Do you know where whores go?" She flushed.
"Or sell themselves for coin.
Or jewels, or gowns, or castles. But where do they go?" The girl could not grasp the question.
"Is it a riddle, my lord? I'm no good at riddles. Will you tell me the answer?"
"No," he thought. "I despise riddles myself. I will tell you nothing. Do me the same favor." "The only part of you that interests me is the part between your legs," he almost said. The words were on his tongue, but somehow never passed his lips. "She is not she," the dwarf told himself. "Only some little fool who thinks I play at riddles." If truth be told, even her cunt did not interest him much. "I must be sick or dead."
"You mentioned a bath. We must not keep the great cheesemonger waiting."
As he bathed, the girl washed his feet, scrubbed his back, and brushed his hair. Afterward, she rubbed sweet-smelling ointment into his calves to ease the aches, and dressed him once again in boy's clothing, a musty pair of burgundy breeches, and a blue velvet doublet lined with cloth of gold.
"Will my lord want me after he has eaten?"
she asked, as she was lacing up his boots.
"No, I am done with women. Whores."
The girl took that disappointment too well for his liking.
"If my lord would prefer a boy, I can have one waiting in his bed."
"My lord would prefer his wife. My lord would prefer a girl named Taisha."
"Only if he knows where whores go."
The girl's mouth tightened. "She despises me," he realized, but no more than I despise myself. That he had fucked many a woman who loathed the very sight of him, Tyrion Lannister had no doubt, but the others had at least the grace to feign affection. A little honest loathing might be refreshing, like a tart wine after too much sweet. "I believe I have changed my mind," he told her. "Wait for me a bed, naked, if you please. I'll be a deal too drunk to fumble at your clothing. Keep your mouth shut and your thighs open, and the two of us should get on splendidly." He gave her a leer, hoping for a taste of fear, but all she gave him was revulsion. No one fears a dwarf. Even Lord Tywin had not been afraid, though Tyrion had held a crossbow in his hands. "Do you moan when you are being fucked?" he asked the bed-warmer.
"If it please my lord."
"It might please my lord to strangle you. That's how I served my last whore. Do you think your master would object?" "Surely not. He has 100 more like you, but no one else like me." This time, when he grinned, he got the fear he wanted. Illyrio was reclining on a padded couch, gobbling hot peppers and pearl onions from a wooden bowl. His brow was dotted with beads of sweat, his pig eyes shining above his fat cheeks. Jewels danced when he moved his hands, onyx and opal, tiger's eye and tourmaline, ruby, amethyst, sapphire, emerald, jet and jade, a black diamond, and a green pearl. "I could live for years on his rings," Tyrion mused, "though I'd need a cleaver to claim them." "Come sit, my little friend," Illyrio waved him closer. The dwarf clambered up to a chair. It was much too big for him. A cushioned throne intended to accommodate the magister's massive buttocks, with thick, sturdy legs to bear his weight. Tyrion Lannister had lived all his life in a world that was too big for him, but in the manse of Illyrio Mopatis, the sense of disproportion assumed grotesque dimensions. "I am a mouse in a mammoth's lair," he mused, "though at least the mammoth keeps a good cellar." The thought made him thirsty. He called for wine. "Did you enjoy the girl I sent you?" Illyrio asked. "If I'd wanted a girl, I would have asked for one." "If she failed to please, she did all that was required of her." "I would hope so. She was trained in lice, where they make an art of love. The king enjoyed her greatly." "I kill kings, and you heard?" Tyrion smiled evilly over his wine cup. "I want no royal leavings." "As you wish. Let us eat." Illyrio tapped his hands together, and serving men came running. They began with a broth of crab and monkfish, and cold egg lime soup as well. Then came quails in honey, a saddle of lamb, goose livers drowned in wine, buttered parsnips, and suckling pig. The sight of it all made Tyrion feel queasy, but he forced himself to try a spoon of soup for the sake of politeness, and once he had tasted, he was lost. The cooks might be old and fat, but they knew their business. He had never eaten so well, even at court. As he was sucking the meat off the bones of his quail, he asked Illyrio about the morning summons. The fat man shrugged. "There are troubles in the east. Astapor has fallen, and Meereen. Gescari slave cities that were old when the world was young." The suckling pig was carved. Illyrio reached for a piece of the crackling, dipped it in a plum sauce, and ate it with his fingers. "Slaver's Bay is a long way from Pentos." Tyrion speared a goose liver on the point of his knife. "No man is as cursed as the Kinslayer," he mused, "but I could learn to like this hell." "This is so," Illyrio agreed, "but the world is one great web, and a man dare not touch a single strand, lest all the others tremble." "More wine?" Illyrio popped a pepper into his mouth. "No, something better." He clapped his hands together. At the sound, a serving man entered with a covered dish. He placed it in front of Tyrion, and Illyrio leaned across the table to remove the lid. "Mushrooms," the magister announced, as the smell wafted up. kissed with garlic and bathed in butter. I am told the taste is exquisite. Have one, my friend. Have two. Tyrion had a fat black mushroom halfway to his mouth, but something in Illyrio's voice made him stop abruptly. After you, my lord. He pushed the dish towards his host. No, no, Magister Illyrio pushed the mushrooms back. For a heartbeat, it seemed as if a mischievous boy was peering out from inside the cheesemonger's bloated flesh. After you, I insist. Cook made them specially for you. Did she indeed? He remembered the cook, the flour in her hands, heavy breasts shot through with dark blue veins. That was kind of her, but no. Tyrion eased the mushroom back into the lake of butter from which it had emerged. You are too suspicious. Illyrio smiled through his forked yellow beard. Oiled every morning to make them gleam like gold, Tyrion suspected. Are you craven? I had not heard that of you. In the Seven Kingdoms, it is considered a grave breach of hospitality to poison your guest at supper. Here as well, Illyrio Mopatis reached for his wine cup. Yet when a guest plainly wishes to end his own life, why, his host must oblige him, no? He took a gulp. Magister Ordello was poisoned by a mushroom not half a year ago. The pain is not so much, I am told. Some cramping in the gut, a sudden ache behind the eyes, and it is gone. Better a mushroom than a sword through your neck, is it not so? Why die with a taste of blood in your mouth, when it could be butter and garlic? The dwarf studied the dish before him. The smell of garlic and butter had his mouth watering. Some part of him wanted those mushrooms, even knowing what they were. He was not brave enough to take cold steel to his own belly. But a bite of mushroom would not be so hard. That frightened him more than he could say. "You mistake me," he heard himself say. "Is it so, I wonder? If you would sooner drown in wine, say the word, and it should be done, and quickly. Drowning cup by cup wastes time and wine both." "You mistake me," Tyrion said again, more loudly. The buttered mushrooms glistened in the lamplight, dark and inviting. "I have no wish to die, I promise you. I have..." His voice trailed off into uncertainty. "What do I have? A life to live, work to do, children to raise, lands to rule, a woman to love?" "You have nothing," finished Magister Illyrio. "But we can change that." He plucked a mushroom from the butter and chewed it lustily. "Mmm, delicious." "The mushrooms are not poisoned?" Tyrion was irritated. "No, why should I wish you ill?" Magister Illyrio ate another. "We must show a little trust, you and I. Come, eat." He clapped his hands again. "We have work to do, my little friend. Must keep his strength up." The serving men brought out a heron, stuffed with figs, veal cutlets blanched with almond milk, creamed herring, candied onions, foul-smelling cheeses, plates of snails and sweetbreads, and a black swan in her plumage. Tyrion refused the swan, which reminded him of a supper with his sister. He helped himself to heron and herring, though, and a few of the sweet onions, and the serving man filled his wine cup anew each time he emptied it. "You drink a deal of wine for such a little man." "Kinslaying is dry work. It gives a man a thirst." The fat man's eyes glittered like the gemstones on his fingers. "There are those in Westeros who would say that killing Lord Lannister was merely a good beginning." "They'd better not say it in my sister's hearing, or they will find themselves short a tongue." The dwarf tore a loaf of bread in half. "And you had best be careful what you say of my family, Magister. Kinslayer or no, I am a lion still." That seemed to amuse the Lord of Cheese no end. He slapped a meaty thigh and said, "You, Westerosi, are all the same. You sew some beast upon a scrap of silk, and suddenly you're all lions, or dragons, or eagles. I can take you to a real lion, my little friend. The prince keeps some pride in his menagerie. Would you like to share a cage with them?" The lords of the Seven Kingdoms did make rather much of their sigils, Tyrion had to admit. "Very well," he conceded. "A Lannister is not a lion. Yet I'm still my father's son, and Jaime and Cersei are mine to kill." "How odd that you should mention your fair sister," said Illyrio between snails. "The queen has offered a lordship to the man who brings her your head, no matter how humble his birth." It was no more than Tyrion had expected. "If you mean to take her up on it, make her spread her legs for you as well. The best part of me for the best part of her. That's a fair trade."
I would sooner have my own weight in gold." The cheesemonger laughed so hard that Tyrion feared he was about to rupture. "All the gold in Castle Rock. Why not?"
"The gold I grant you," the dwarf said, relieved that he was not about to drown in a gout of half-digested eels and sweetmeats. "But the rock is mine."
"Just so." The magister covered his mouth and belched a mighty belch. "Do you think King Stannis will give it to you? I'm told he's a great one for the law. Your brother wears the white cloak, so you are heir by all the laws of Westeros."
"Stannis might well grant me Castle Rock," said Tyrion, "but for the small matter of regicide and kinslaying. For those he would short me by a head, and I am short enough as I stand. But why would you think I mean to join Lord Stannis?"
"Why else would you go to the wall?"
"Stannis is at the wall." Tyrion rubbed at his nose. "What in seven bloody hells is Stannis doing at the wall?"
"Shivering, I would think. It's warmer down in Dorne. Perhaps he should have sailed that way."
Tyrion was beginning to suspect that a certain freckled washerwoman knew more about the common speech than she pretended. "My niece Missella is in Dorne, as it happens, and I have half a mind to make her a queen." Illyrio smiled as his serving men spooned out bowls of black cherries in sweet cream for them both.
"What has this poor child done to you that you would wish her dead?"
"Even a kinslayer is not required to slay all his kin," said Tyrion, wounded. "Queen her," I said, "not kill her." The cheesemonger spooned up cherries.
"In Valentis they use a coin with a crown on one face and a death's head on the other. Yet it is the same coin. To queen her is to kill her. Dawn might rise for Marcella, but dawn alone is not enough. If you are as clever as our friend insists, you know this."
Tyrion looked at the fat man with new interest. "He is right, on both counts. To queen her is to kill her, and I knew that. Futile gestures are all that remain to me. This one would make my sister weep bitter tears at least." Magister Illyrio wiped sweet cream from his mouth with the back of a fat hand.
"The road to Castle Rock does not go through Dorne, my little friend, nor does it run beneath the wall. Yet there is such a road, I tell you."
"I am an attainted traitor, a regicide, and kingslayer." This talk of roads annoyed him. "Does he think this is a game?"
"What one king does, another may undo. In Pentos we have a prince, my friend. He presides at ball and feast, and rides about the city in a palanquin of ivory and gold. Three heralds go before him, with the golden scales of trade, the iron sword of war, and the silver scourge of justice. On the first day of each new year, he must deflower the maid of the fields and the maid of the seas."
Illyrio leaned forward, elbows on the table.
"Yet should a crop fail, or a war be lost, we cut his throat to appease the gods and choose a new prince from amongst the 40 families." Remind me never to become the Prince of Pentas. Are your seven kingdoms so different? There is no peace in Westeros, no justice, no faith, and soon enough, no food. When men are starving and sick of fear, they look for a savior. They may look, but if all they find is Stannis, not Stannis, nor Missella, the yellow smile widened. Another, stronger than Tommen, gentler than Stannis, with a better claim than the girl Missella. A savior come from across the sea to bind up the wounds of bleeding Westeros. Fine words. Tyrion was unimpressed. Words are wind. Who is this bloody savior? A dragon. The cheesemonger saw the look on his face at that and laughed. A dragon with three heads. Daenerys. She could hear the dead man coming up the steps. The slow, measured sound of footsteps went before him, echoing amongst the purple pillars of her hall. Daenerys Targaryen awaited him upon the ebon bench that she had made her throne. Her eyes were soft with sleep, her silver-gold hair all tousled.
"Your Grace," said Sir Barristan Selmy, the Lord Commander of a Queen's Guard, "there is no need for you to see this. He died for me."
Danny clutched a lion pelt to her chest. Underneath, a sheer white linen tunic covered her to mid-thigh. She had been dreaming of a house with a red door when Missandei woke her. There had been no time to dress.
"Khaleesi," whispered Eri, "you must not touch the dead man. It is bad luck to touch the dead."
"Unless you kill them yourself." Jiqui was bigger bone than Eri, with wide hips and heavy breasts.
"That is known."
"It is known," Eri agreed. Dothraki were wise where horses were concerned, but could be utter fools about much else.
"They are only girls, besides."
Her handmaids were of an age with her. Women grown to look at them, with their black hair, copper-skinned and almond-shaped eyes, but girls all the same. They had been given to her when she wed Khal Drogo. It was Drogo who had given her the pelt she wore, the head and hide of Rakha, the white lion of the Dothraki Sea. It was too big for her and had a musty smell, but it made her feel as if her sun and stars were still near her. Grey Worm appeared atop the steps first, a torch in hand. His bronze cap was crested with three spikes. Behind him followed four of his unsullied, bearing the dead man on their shoulders. Their caps had only one spike each, and their faces showed so little they might have been cast in bronze as well. They laid the corpse down at her feet. Sir Barristan pulled back the blood-stained shroud. Grey Worm lowered the torch so she might see. The dead man's face was smooth and hairless, though his cheeks had been slashed open ear to ear. He had been a tall man, blue-eyed and fair of face.
"Some child of Lys or old Valentus, snatched off a ship by corsairs and sold into bondage in Red Astapor."
Though his eyes were open, it was his wounds that wept. There were more wounds than she could count.
"Your Grace," Sir Barristan said, "there was a harpy drawn on the bricks in the alley where he was found." "Drawn in blood." Daenerys knew the way of it by now.
The sons of the harpy did their butchery by night. Over each kill they left their mark.
"Grey Worm, why was this man alone? Had he no partner?"
By her command, when the unsullied walked the streets of Meereen by night, they always walked in pairs.
"My queen," replied the captain, "your servant, Stallworth's shield, had no duty last night. He had gone to a certain place to drink and have companionship."
"A certain place? What do you mean?"
"A house of pleasure, your grace."
"A brothel." Half of her freedmen were from Yunkai, where the wise masters had been famed for training bed slaves.
"The way of the seven sighs."
Brothels had sprouted up like mushrooms all over Meereen. It's all they know. They need to survive. Food was more costly every day, whilst the price of flesh grew cheaper. In the poorer districts between the step pyramids of Meereen's slaver nobility, there were brothels catering to every conceivable erotic taste she knew.
Even so, what could a eunuch hope to find in a brothel?
"Even those who lack a man's parts may still have a man's heart, Your Grace," said Grey Worm. "This one has been told that your servant Stalwart Shield sometimes gave coin to the women of the brothels to lie with him and hold him."
"The blood of the dragon does not weep."
"Stalwart Shield," she said dry-eyed.
"That was his name?"
"If it please Your Grace."
"It is a fine name."
The good masters of Astapor had not allowed their slave soldiers even names. Some of her unsullied reclaimed their birth names after she had freed them. Others chose new names for themselves.
"Is it known how many attackers fell upon Stalwart Shield?"
"This one does not know. Many."
"Six or more," said Sir Barristan. "From the look of his wounds, they swarmed him from all sides. He was found with an empty scabbard. It may be that he wounded some of his attackers."
Dennis said a silent prayer that somewhere one of the harpy's sons was dying even now, clutching at his belly and writhing in pain.
"Why did they cut open his cheeks like that?"
"Gracious Queen," said Grey Worm, "his killers had forced the genitals of a goat down the throat of your servant, Stalwart Shield. This one removed them before bringing him here."
"They could not feed him his own genitals. The Astapori left him neither root nor stem." "The sons grow bolder,"
Danny observed. Until now they had limited their attacks to unarmed freedmen, cutting them down in the streets or breaking into their homes under the cover of darkness to murder them in their beds.
"This is the first of my soldiers they have slain."
"The first," Sir Barristan warned, "but not the last."
"I am still at war," Danny realized. "Only now I am fighting shadows."
She had hoped for a respite from the killing, for some time to build and heal. Shrugging off the lion pelt, she knelt beside the corpse and closed the dead man's eyes, ignoring Jiqui's gasp.
"Stalwart Shield shall not be forgotten. Have him washed and dressed for battle, and bury him with cap and shield and spear."
"It shall be as Your Grace commands," said Grey Worm.
"Send men to the Temple of the Graces, and ask if any man has come to the Blue Graces with a sword wound, and spread the word that we will pay good gold for the short sword of Stalwart Shield. Inquire of the butchers and the herdsmen, and learn who has been gelding goats of late.
Perhaps some goat-herd would confess.
Henceforth, no man of mine walks alone after dark."
"This one shall obey."
Daenerys pushed her hair back.
"Find these cowards for me. Find them, so that I might teach the harpy's sons what it means to wake the dragon."
Grey Worm saluted her. His unsullied closed the shroud once more, lifted the dead man onto their shoulders, and bore him from the hall. Sir Barristan Selmyr remained behind. His hair was white, and there were crow's feet at the corners of his pale blue eyes. Yet his back was still unbent, and the years had not rubbed him of his skill at arms.
"Your Grace," he said, "I fear your eunuchs are ill-suited for the tasks you set them."
Danae settled on her bench and wrapped her pelt about her shoulders once again.
"The unsullied are my finest warriors."
Soldiers, not warriors, if it please Your Grace. They were made for the battlefield, to stand shoulder to shoulder behind their shields with their spears thrust out before them. Their training teaches them to obey fearlessly, perfectly, without thought or hesitation, not to unravel secrets or ask questions.
"Would knights serve me any better?"
Selmy was training knights for her, teaching the sons of slaves to fight with lance and longsword in the Westerosi fashion. But what good would lances do against cowards who kill from the shadows?
"Not in this," the old man admitted, "and your grace has no knights, save me. It will be years before the boys are ready." "Then who, if not Unsullied? Dothraki would be even worse."
"Dothraki fought from horseback. Mounted men were of more use in open fields and hills than in the narrow streets and alleys of the city. Beyond Meereen's walls are many-colored brick. Danny's rule was tenuous at best. Thousands of slaves still toiled on vast estates in the hills, growing wheat and olives, herding sheep and goats, and mining salt and copper. Meereen's storehouses held ample supplies of grain, oil, olives, dried fruit, and salted meat. But the stores were dwindling. So Danny had dispatched her tiny Khalasar to subdue the hinterlands, under the command of her three blood riders, whilst Brown Ben Plum took his second son south to guard against Yunkish incursions. The most crucial task of all she had entrusted to Dario Naharis, glib-tongued Dario with his gold tooth and trident beard, smiling his wicked smile through purple whiskers. Beyond the eastern hills was a range of rounded sandstone mountains, the Kaizai Pass and Lazar. If Dario could convince the Lazarine to reopen the overland trade routes, grains could be brought down the river or over the hills at need. But the Lamb men had no reason to love Meereen.
"When the storm crows return from Lazar, perhaps I can use them in the streets," she told Sir Barristan. "But until then, I have only the Unsullied."
Danny rose.
"You must excuse me, sir. The petitioners will soon be at my gates. I must don my floppy ears and become their queen again. Summon Resnack and the Sheath Pate. I'll see them when I'm dressed."
"As your grace commands,"
Selmy bowed.
The great pyramid shouldered 800 feet into the sky, from its huge square base to the lofty apex where the queen kept her private chambers, surrounded by greenery and fragrant pools. As a cool blue dawn broke over the city, Danny walked out onto the terrace. To the west, sunlight blazed off the golden domes of the Temple of the Graces and etched deep shadows behind the step pyramids of the mighty.
"In some of those pyramids, the sons of the Harpy are plotting new murders even now, and I am powerless to stop them."
Viserion sensed her disquiet. The white dragon lay coiled around a pear tree, his head resting on his tail. When Danny passed, his eyes came open, two pools of molten gold. His horns were gold as well, and the scales that ran down his back from head to tail.
"You're lazy," she told him, scratching under his jaw.
His scales were hot to the touch, like armor left too long in the sun.
"Dragons are fire, made flesh."
She had read that in one of the books Sir Jorah had given her as a wedding gift.
"You should be hunting with your brothers. Have you and Drogon been fighting again?"
Her dragons were growing wild of late. Rhaegal had snapped at Iri, and Viserion had set Resnick's Tokar ablaze the last time the Seneschal had called.
"I've left them too much to themselves, but where am I to find the time for them?"
Viserion's tail lashed sideways, thumping the trunk of the tree so hard that a pear came tumbling down to land at Danny's feet. His wings unfolded, and he half flew, half hopped onto the parapet.
"He grows," she thought, as he launched himself into the sky. "They are all three growing. Soon they will be large enough to bear my weight."
Then she would fly as Aegon the Conqueror had flown, up and up until Meereen was so small that she could blot it out with her thumb. She watched Viserion climb in widening circles until he was lost to sight beyond muddy waters of the Skahazadan. Only then did Danny go back inside the pyramid, where Iri and Jiqui were waiting to brush the tangles from her hair and garber as befit the Queen of Meereen in a Gascari toca. The garment was a clumsy thing, a long, loose, shapeless sheet that had to be wound around her hips and under an arm and over a shoulder, its dangling fringes carefully layered and displayed. Wound too loose, it was like to fall off. Wound too tight, it would tangle, trip, and bind. Even wound properly, the toka required its wearer to hold it in place with a left hand. Walking in a toka demanded small, mincing steps and exquisite balance, lest one tread upon those heavy trailing fringes. It was not a garment meant for any man who had to work. The toka was a master's garment, a sign of wealth and power. Danny had wanted to ban the toka when she took Meereen, but her advisers had convinced her otherwise. "The mother of dragons must don the toka, or be forever hated," warned the Green Grace, Galatza Galari. "In the walls of Westeros, or a gown of Meerish lace, your radiance shall forever remain a stranger amongst us, a grotesque outlander, a barbarian conqueror. Meereen's queen must be a lady of old Gis." Brown Ben Plum, the captain of the Second Sons, had put it more succinctly.
"Man wants to be the king of the rabbits. He'd best wear a pair of floppy ears."
The floppy ears she chose today were made of sheer white linen, with a fringe of golden tassels. With Zhiki's help, she wound the toka about herself correctly on her third attempt. Iri fetched her crown, wrought in the shape of a three-headed dragon of her house. Its coils were gold, its wings silver, its three heads ivory, onyx, and jade. Danny's neck and shoulders would be stiff and sore from the weight of it before the day was done.
"A crown should not sit easy on the head,"
one of her royal forebears had said that once.
"Some Aegon, but which one?"
5 Aegons had ruled the 7 kingdoms of Westeros. There would have been a 6th, but the usurper's dogs had murdered her brother's son when he was still a babe at the breast.
"If he had lived, I might have married him. Aegon would have been closer to my age than Viserys."
Danny had only been conceived when Aegon and his sister were murdered. Their father, her brother Rhaegar, perished even earlier, slain by the usurper on the Trident. Her brother Viserys had died screaming in Vaes Dothrak, with a crown of molten gold upon his head.
"They would kill me too, if I allow it. The knives that slew my stalwart shield were meant for me."
She had not forgotten the slave children the great masters had nailed up along the road from Yunkai. They had numbered 163, a child every mile, nailed to mileposts, with one arm outstretched to point her way. After Meereen had fallen, Danny had nailed up a light number of great masters. Swarms of flies had attended their slow dying, and the stench had lingered long in the plaza. Yet some day she feared that she had not gone far enough. These Meereenese were a sly and stubborn people, who resisted her at every turn. They had freed their slaves, yes, only to hire them back as servants at wages so meagre that most could scarce afford to eat. Those too old or young to be of use had been cast into the streets, along with the infirm and the crippled. And still the great masters gathered atop their lofty pyramids to complain of how the Dragon Queen had filled their noble city with hordes of unwashed beggars, thieves, and whores.
"To rule Meereen, I must win the Meereenese, however much I may despise them. I am ready," she told Iri.
Reznak and Skahaz waited atop the marble steps. "Great Queen," declared Reznak Mo Reznak, "you are so radiant today, I fear to look on you." The seneschal wore a toka of maroon silk with a golden fringe. A small, damp man, he smelled as if he had bathed in perfume and spoke a bastard form of High Valyrian, much corrupted and flavored with a thick Gascari growl.
"You are kind to say so," Danny answered in the same tongue.
My queen, growled Skahaz Mokandak of the Shaven Head.
Giskari hair was dense and wiry. It had long been the fashion for the men of the slaver cities to tease it into horns and spikes and wings. By shaving, Skahaz had put old Miri in behind him to accept the new, and his kin had done the same after his example. Others followed, though whether from fear, fashion, or ambition, Danny could not say. Shave pates, they were called. Skahaz was the shave pate, and the vilest of traitors to the sons of the Harpy and their ilk.
We were told about the eunuch. His name was Stalwart Shield. More will die unless the murderers are punished.
Even with his shaven scalp, Skahaz had an odious face, a beetled brow, small eyes with heavy bags beneath them, a big nose dark with blackheads, oily skin that looked more yellow than the usual amber of Giskari. It was a blunt, brutal, angry face. She could only pray it was an honest one as well.
"Well, how can I punish them when I do not know who they are?"
Danny demanded of him.
"Tell me that, bold Skahaz."
"You have no lack of enemies, your grace. You can see their pyramids from your terrace. Zak, Haskar, Gazin, Merrick, Lorak, all the old slaving families. Pal, most of all. A house of women now. Bitter old women with a taste for blood. Women do not forget. Women do not forgive."
"No," Danny thought, "and the usurper's dogs will learn that when I return to Westeros."
It was true that there was blood between her and the House of Pal. Osnag Zopal had been cut down by strong Belwas in single combat. His father, commander of Mirian City Watch, had died defending the gates when Jasso's cock smashed them into splinters. Three uncles had been among the 163 on the plaza.
"How much gold have we offered for information concerning the sons of the Harpy?" Danny asked.
100 honors, if it please your radiance."
1,000 honors would please us more. Make it so."
"Your grace has not asked for my counsel," said Skahar Shavepate. "But I say that blood must pay for blood. Take one man from each of the families I've named and kill him. The next time one of yours is slain, take two from each great house and kill them both. There will not be a third murder."
Resnick squealed in distress.
"No, gentle queen, such savagery would bring down the ire of the gods. We will find the murderers, I promise you. And when we do, they will prove to be base-born filth. You shall see."
The seneschal was as bold as Skahaz, though in his case the gods were responsible.
"Should any here be so insolent as to appear, my barber stands with razor ready," he had assured her when she raised him up.
There were times when Danny wondered if that razor might not be better saved for Resnick's throat. He was a useful man, but she liked him little and trusted him less. Then dying of Karth had told her she would be thrice betrayed. Miri Mazdur had been the first, Ser Jorah the second. Would Resnick be the third, the shave-pate, Dario?
Or will it be someone I would never suspect? Sir Barristan, or Grey Worm, or Missandei? "Skahaz," she told the shave-pate, I thank you for your counsel. Resnick, see what 1,000 honors may accomplish."
Clutching her toka, Daenerys swept past them down the broad marble stair. She took one step at a time, lest she trip over her fringe and go tumbling head first into court. Missandei announced her. The little scribe had a sweet, strong voice.
"All kneel for Daenerys Stormborn, the Unburnt, Queen of Meereen, Queen of the Andals, and the Rhoynar, and the First Men, Khaleesi of Great Grass Sea, Breaker of Shackles, and Mother of Dragons."
The hall had filled. Unsullied stood with their backs to the pillars, holding shields and spears, the spikes on their caps jutting upward like a row of knives. The Myrinese had gathered beneath the eastern windows. Her freedmen stood well apart from their former masters.
"Until they stand together, Meereen will know no peace." "Arise," Danny settled into her bench. The hall rose. "That, at least, they do as one."
Resnak Mo Resnak had a list. Custom demanded that the queen begin with the Astapori envoy, a former slave who called himself Lord Gale, though no one seemed to know what he was lord of. Lord Gale had a mouth of brown and rotten teeth, and the pointed yellow face of a weasel. He also had a gift. "Cleon the Great sends these slippers as a token of his love for Daenerys Stormborn, the mother of dragons." Irie slid the slippers onto Danny's feet. They were gilded leather, decorated with green freshwater pearls.
"Does the Butcher King believe a pair of pretty slippers will win my hand?" "King Cleon is most generous. You may thank him for his lovely gift." "Lovely, but made for a child."
Danny had small feet, yet the pointed slippers mashed her toes together.
"Great Cleon would be pleased to know they pleased you," said Lord Gale. "His magnificence bids me say that he stands ready to defend the mother of dragons from all her foes."
"If he propose again that I wed King Cleon, I'll throw a slipper at his head," Danny thought.
But for once the Astapori envoy made no mention of a royal marriage. Instead he said, "The time has come for Astapor and Meereen to end the savage reign of the wise masters of Yunkai, who are sworn foes to all those who live in freedom. Great Cleon bids me tell you that he and his new Unsullied will soon march."
"His new Unsullied are an obscene jape. King Cleon would be wise to tend his own gardens and let the Yunkai tend theirs."
It was not that Danny harbored any love for Yunkai. She was coming to regret leaving the Yellow City untaken after defeating its army in the field. The wise masters had returned to slaving as soon as she moved on, and were busy raising levies, hiring sellswords, and making alliances against her. Cleon, the self-styled great, was no better, however. The Butcher King had restored slavery to Astapor, the only change being that the former slaves were now the masters, and the former masters were now the slaves.
"I am only a young girl, and know little of the ways of war," she told Lord Gale. "But we have heard that Astapor is starving. Let King Cleon feed his people before he leads them out to battle."
She made a gesture of dismissal. Gale withdrew.
"Magnificence," prompted Resnak Mo Resnak. "Will you hear the noble Hisdarzo Lorek?"
"Again?" Danny nodded, and Hisdar strode forth, a tall man, very slender, with flawless amber skin. He bowed on the same spot where Stalwart Shield had lain in death not long before.
"I need this man," Danny reminded herself.
Hisdar was a wealthy merchant, with many friends in Meereen, and more across the seas. He had visited Volantis, Lys, and Karth, had kin in Tolos and Illyria, and was even said to wield some influence in New Gis, where the Yunkai were trying to stir up enmity against Danny and her rule. And he was rich, famously and fabulously rich.
"And like to grow richer, if I grant his petition."
When Danny had closed the city's fighting pits, the value of pit shares had plummeted. Hisdar Zolorek had grabbed them up with both hands, and now owned most of the fighting pits in Meereen. The nobleman had wings of wiry red-black hair sprouting from his temples. They made him look as if his head were about to take flight. His long face was made even longer by a beard bound with rings of gold. His purple tokar was fringed with amethysts and pearls.
"Your radiance will know the reason I am here." "Why, it must be because you have no other purpose but to plague me. How many times have I refused you?" 5 times, your magnificence," 6 now. I will not have the fighting pits reopened. If your majesty will hear my arguments... I have. 5 times. Have you brought new arguments? Old arguments, Hisdar admitted. New words, lovely words, and courteous, more apt to move a queen. It is your cause I find wanting, not your courtesies. I've heard your argument so often, I could plead your case myself. Shall I?
Danny leaned forward. The fighting pits have been a part of Meereen since the city was founded. The combats are profoundly religious in nature, a blood sacrifice to the gods of Gis. The mortal art of Gis is not mere butchery, but a display of courage, skill, and strength most pleasing to your gods. Victorious fighters are pampered and acclaimed, and the slain are honored and remembered. By reopening the pits, I would show the people of Meereen that I respect their ways and customs. The pits are far famed across the world. They draw trade to Meereen and fill the city's coffers with coin from the ends of the earth. All men share a taste for blood. A taste the pits help slake. In that way they make Meereen more tranquil. For criminals condemned to die upon the sands, the pits represent a judgment by battle, a last chance for a man to prove his innocence. She leaned back again, with a toss of her head.
There. How have I done? Your radiance has stated the case much better than I could have hoped to do myself. I see that you are eloquent as well as beautiful. I am quite persuaded. She had to laugh. But I am not.
Your magnificence, whispered Resnick Mo Resnick in her ear. It is customary for the city to claim 1/10 of all the profits from the fighting pits, after expenses, as a tax. That coin might be put to many noble uses.
It might, though if we were to reopen the pits, we should take our 10th before expenses. I am only a young girl and know little of such matters, but I dwelt with Zarozo and Daxos long enough to learn that much. Hisdar, if you could marshal armies as you marshal arguments, you could conquer the world. But my answer is still no. For the 6th time.
The queen has spoken. He bowed again, as deeply as before. His pearls and amethysts clattered softly against the marble floor. A very limber man was Hisdar Zolorek.
Yeah, he might be handsome, but for that silly hair.
Resnick and the Green Grace had been urging Danny to take a Meereenese noble for her husband, to reconcile the city to her rule. Hisdar Zolorek might be worth a careful look. Sooner him than Scar has. The shave-pate had offered to set aside his wife for her, but the notion made her shudder. Hisdar, at least, knew how to smile.
"Magnificence," said Resnick, consulting his list. "The noble Grazdan Zogalari would address you. Will you hear him?"
"It would be my pleasure," said Danny, admiring the glimmer of the gold and the sheen of the green pearls on Cleon's slippers, while doing her best to ignore the pinching in her toes.
Grazdan, she had been forewarned, was a cousin of the Green Grace, whose support she had found invaluable. The priestess was a voice for peace, acceptance, and obedience to lawful authority.
I can give her cousin a respectful hearing, whatever he desires.
What he desired turned out to be gold. Danny had refused to compensate any of the great masters for the value of their slaves, but the Meereenese kept devising other ways to squeeze coin from her. The noble Grazdan had once owned a slave woman who was a very fine weaver, it seemed. The fruits of her loom were greatly valued, not only in Meereen, but in New Gis and Astapor and Karth. When this woman had grown old, Grazdan had purchased 6 young girls and commanded the crone to instruct them in the secrets of her craft. The old woman was dead now. The young ones, freed, had opened a shop by the harbour wall to sell their weavings. Grazdan Zogalari asked that he be granted a portion of their earnings,
"'They owe their skill to me,' he insisted. "'I plucked them from the auction block and gave them to the loom.'
Danny listened quietly, her face still.